I'm Lisa, and this is Keeping It Real. It's our summer membership drive at KBOO Radio until the end of this week, and this is your chance to support independent media. We're trying to raise $50,000 by the end of June, and we need your help to do that. You can make a contribution at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number, 44321. Or on the app, you can tap the red button at the top that says donate, or you can send us a contribution in a physical envelope to KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. When you make a contribution to KBOO, you are literally supporting the democracy that comes from the free flow of information and critical thought. I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest today is Donovan Scribes. He edited Blackout, the recent Portland Mercury special edition, looking at the Black Lives Matter movement 5 years later. In the process, he helps define who we are at the current pivotal moment in society. He is a modern griot. I'm calling you that. You're a modern griot, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later. Thanks for being here, Donovan.
Thank you for having me again.
Let's start out with a question that probably everybody knows the answer to, but it's maybe the most important question to ask. Who was George Floyd?
I mean, George Floyd was a lot of things. He was a Texas native. He, you know, I found out sometime after we all kind of found out his name that he was a rapper, he was an artist, you know, he was a father. And George Floyd ultimately should be somebody that we don't really know who he is. He should just be somebody who's living his life, but his life was cut short in one of the most vile ways, you know, having somebody smile while they choke the life out of your body, especially because they know they can, and they know they can because they have a badge, and they know that you can have a crowd of people around you, and ultimately those people don't feel empowered to stop what is happening because everybody has an understanding of the dynamic between a police officer and a Black man.
I have to say too that, and this is not about George Floyd himself, but to me, one of the most remarkable things that came from the police murder of George Floyd is that the teenager who videotaped his murder on her phone actually got a Pulitzer Prize, a special Pulitzer Prize for doing that, a teenage girl. And when you have the journalistic establishment basically highlighting what an incredible transformational moment that was or should have been for society, and we could talk about that too. Second biggest question, how is the perspective of Portlanders of African descent different from the perspectives of everybody else on this particular history?
Yeah, so Portland, differently than the protests that kind of swept the entire globe at that time, Portland sustained in a way that no other city did. So we had 100 plus days of continuous protests, and that was major. And inside of that, you know, we have such a unique history here in Portland, especially over the last decade and a half of Portland is this really liberal city, and it's really cheap to live there. And, you know, you really have to have a job to be doing well there. That was one narrative that was coming on the hills of Portlandia. And then as that spotlight came, then there was a lot more spotlight on, well, actually, Portland's not just that. Actually, people dug into that history of why it was so white. And that uncovering became a national story more and more and more. And that was also a story that a lot of Black people here have known in different ways because we're living it, you know? And in that uncovering, I just think for the national eyes, especially, while there has been some attention on it, it's definitely not been as widespread as it should be because there is a deep history here in terms of legislated white so-called supremacy and also just general like targeting of our community that's not legislated and how those things work together. And inside of that thing, we also have a strong Black history that is definitely intertwined with that. And so I guess inside of kind of those 100+ days of protests and why it was so important to spotlight Black perspective in it all is we have been witnesses to all of the reasons that people were turning up. And there's something very special to me in showing not just the unison of the voice, but the different perspectives people were having on that moment. And when I was looking at that anniversary and knowing that it was coming up May 25th, 2025, as the 5-year anniversary to George Floyd's murder, I just wanted to make sure it was not just insert quote unquote community leader to talk about what it all means 5 years later. You know, I wanted to give us a collective platform to say this is some of what some of Black Portland is thinking and give us that space to wrestle with what that moment actually is for us, especially because before the 100 days was even up, I saw there seemed to already be a shifting from like, we're all listening to, but do you really mean abolish the police? Do you really mean defund the police? Okay, police oversight board, maybe years from now. Like it was this constant chipping away. And so I did want to get us back to the root of things. And I felt like that could only happen by a collective, not a singular.
I want to come back to this a little bit later, but now I have to say too, Portland is one of the whitest cities in the country. Oregon is an old Klan state, but the truth is, some of the best and brightest Portlanders in the history of our city have come from the African American community specifically. And when I looked at the list of people that contributed to your special edition, it read like a roster of the people who should be running Portland, the people, Rukaya Adams should be mayor. Right? But can we just literally, can you read a list of all the people that contributed to this?
Yeah, so all the writers, not including myself, Devin Boss, Lakeana Drury, Chris Lambert, Bruce Poinsett, Jenny Moore, Nkengue Harman-Johnson, Sharon Gary Smith, Teresa Raford, Glenn Waco, Rekhiah Adams, Juma Say, Justice Raji, Mack Smith. So those are all the people. And then inside of that, I've got three pieces in total, kind of our intro, our closing, and then an interview with Teresa and Glenn.
And this group fascinates me because it's intergenerational. You have people coming from lots of different generations. How did you decide who to approach to do this project, and what was their take on it?
I mean, for me, I'm glad you said that about the intergenerational piece, because that was one of the main things for me is making sure that this was a reach in of different generations and was a conversation. Because even in my first piece, I talk about this issue is ultimately about time, like how time gets away from us. And that is the crux of things, is being able to share those stories through generations and people being able to see those different threads of how our stories are connected across the different generations. And so for me, that was a big piece of who I put in here. Miss Sharon Gary Smith, you know, we worked together in the NAACP, and I just love Miss Sharon and how she makes that kind of space for different generations of thought and approach and still holds herself in it.
Right, I want to interrupt with Sharon Gary Smith because she's one of the first people that I met when I moved to Portland in the 80s. And she's a person who has planted seeds in so many different communities on so many different issues in Portland and Oregon too, and some of them are really hard issues. So in my mind, Sharon Gary Smith is like the godmother of activism in Portland. I just had to say that.
Yeah.
Anyway, keep going.
I wanted to have, you know, Teresa Raford's voice in there because she's been deeply involved in this work. Her family comes from, you know, a lot of these issues that we talk about and been standing in the middle of the resistance movement for some time. I wanted to have Lakiana in there because he's been mentoring Black men or young Black boys for some time in this city. And Black boys are not often centered in a conversation, but they are headlines of conversations about what's wrong in our city often. And so he was able to make something really beautiful and encapsulating what it is to grow up in this city as a young Black man and have options kind of presented for you, whether covertly or overtly. And then Bruce has been a friend, and obviously he worked at the scanner before me, and we kind of started our writing paths at the same time. And you know, he has been similar to me of just kind of trying to uplift stories for a long time, but beyond lifting up different stories across the state around Black people in Oregon, he has started this organization with his mom in Lake Oswego, where they're both from. And I knew that in terms of the story of Portland, there also was this outside of Portland thing that was happening during 2020, especially in the suburbs, because that was one of the more surprising things, is that the suburbs of a lot of different cities were also participating in the protests. And so I wanted him to give voice to what that looked like, because it's a slightly different thing. And cities and suburbs definitely have a strong history in terms of Blackness and other races too, because a lot of suburbs are created literally to get away from Black people. And so he grew up in that. And with Justice Raji, you know, Reimagine Oregon is such a unique platform because it came from this coalition of organizations responding to what was happening outside and putting the government on the clock. So that was a kind of exciting thing to see at that time in 2020. It's because there's no shortage of documents and like we're listenings and all that that's happened across the years. But in 2020, them saying, okay, Multnomah County, Washington County, Clackamas County, State of Oregon, education, housing, police, all of these different things, we want to see this specific outcome on this specific timeline. And so that was very different than what we've witnessed in this state's history. And so his piece, Accountability is a Practice, he really got to dive in with what did that actually look like, and reminding people that this is not just something to say, it's something to do. And then with this interview with Rekhiah Adams and Juma Say from 1803 Fund was in their office talking about Blackout before it all came to fruition, and spent some time looking at that picture on the bridge because it's in 1803's office. And she Rekhiah was explaining to me at that time that that was what kind of helped spur her to write the first draft of 1803 Fund. And that
That's
is
incredible. That's incredible. That's historic right now. Just
it.
to jump in right now, people who are listening, you don't know what the 1803 Fund is, but Rekhiah Adams, again, she's one of the geniuses of our local community, born and raised here, and she's done all kinds of financial things, but she got this big idea for a fund that could actually realistically help give money to local African and African American groups and individuals to start businesses and to do big ideas. And she got almost a half $1 billion from the richest guy in Oregon, right? She got $400 million from Phil Knight. Like, it's historic. And you're telling me that she was really inspired to do that from. And again, okay, so the picture on the bridge that Donovan's talking about is a picture of the Burnside Bridge. It's from the western side facing the eastern side, and the entire bridge is absolutely packed with people like you've never seen it during the Rose Festival or anything like that. It looks like something from like the 60s. It's so full of people that you're blowing my mind right now. And this is what I'm getting at, like Donovan Scribes, you put your finger on who is the real brains behind the things that happen here. You know, was it Ted Wheeler? But I have to also break here and say, hey, my friends, it's the summer Membership Drive. Whether you're a new listener or a longtime fan, the most important thing you need to know about KBOO Radio is that we do not accept corporate advertising whatsoever. We rely on real human beings to power our broadcasts. That's why we're asking you to pitch in some cash at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number, 44321. Or on the app, you can tap the red button at the top that says donate, or you can send us a contribution in a physical envelope to KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Your donation stays right here in our local area. No part of it goes into the war machine or the hostile government takeover. Thanks for considering a donation, and thanks to everyone who has given so far. This is Keeping It Real. I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest today is Donovan Scribes. He edited Blackout, the recent Portland Mercury special edition looking at the Black Lives Matter movement 5 years later. In the process, he helps define who we are at the current pivotal moment in society. Blows my mind what you did with that, too. I'm going to walk this back a little bit and say, when I read through it, the thing that gets me is this whole special edition is about something that happened 5 years ago and beyond, right? Of course. But so much of it is about the future. Like, I think every one of these people who wrote for this is talking about the future. Am I imagining that? What's going on there?
Yeah, it absolutely is about the future. And to that end, I want to make sure I name some other people because I left out a couple names. So Max Smith has a piece in there as well as Jenny Moore. And to that very question, like about the future, Jenny's piece is great, and it's such a different take on what is happening in our city and our country because hers is about birth. You know, she was
Why to
pregnant.
have a baby now?
Why to have a baby now? And so, like that in definition is about the future. As her piece really gets to like to the crux of so much of what happened with George Floyd. Like this man screamed for his mom as he was dying. And he was like 44, 45 years old when he was murdered. And it shows kind of that inherent connection that we all have to, you know, our life source. And here we have somebody who is pregnant, who has a toddler, talking about people telling her that it's foolish to give birth in a time like now, and really looking at what models keep us together. And she's making a case for a village model for connectivity, for staying together. And then in that same way, Max Smith's piece is about police abolition, which is also in itself future facing. It's about looking towards the future because the current that we have has been in place for a long time. So to be an abolitionist, you have to be forward facing, and you have to also have some level of hope towards the future too. And his piece intertwines with Jenny's in a lot of ways too, because he's making a similar case of you got to be able to grow your own food. You got to know who's who in your community. You got to be connected. That's also what abolition is about, police abolition, because it ultimately is about dismantling laws and systems that don't serve humanity, the collective. And if we can look at those things and that hopefulness that it really is, then I think we can, you know, have some different conversations because I think police abolition in particular has such a fire and dreariness tied to it as the image that comes with it. And I'll admit, even for myself, I didn't really make that next step of where I have been living with police into abolition until 2020. But when I didn't just see it on Instagram and say, that's what I'm doing. I read more about it, and it's really logically, these are the next steps when you look at not just police budgets. People get stuck on police budgets and absolutely should, because look at them comparatively to all the other services in your community and tell me if that's right. But when you go beyond that and you think about the stockpile of weapons that they have targeted towards primarily poor people and black people and brown people, just that's what those weapons are there for, is how many billions of dollars of weapons are stockpiled in any given police department right now. If we just did a tracking of that and how much of that money could be going back into keeping people housed, into keeping people fed, into keeping people with activities that they can go to into their communities, having roads that are paved, you know, all the things that you might see in the Happy Valley or the West Hills, for example. But anyways, yes, this issue is ultimately about the future, and I wanted people to see there is an interconnectedness between, in my view, between Mac's vision and between 1803's vision. 1803 is seeing that capital is something that our communities need, and long-term capital. And so what they're doing is funding organizations that do give people that stability, that oftentimes don't even have the resources to pull off what they've been pulling off, and people are stressing themselves out just to get these things done that our community needs. So like a taking ownership existing in our community where they started in 2020, going and fixing up Black elders' houses and making sure that they could stay rooted. You know, as we talk about gentrification, there are a lot of Black elders that still have their homes that haven't been able to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak. And so making sure that that equity is building in their homes and that that is a generational wealth thing that can be passed on, that's a major thing. And so them starting in 2020 and being able to get the funding from 1803 for 5 years to be able to make sure that they're not in the same grant hustle that is like across your fingers all the time, that is a major thing for our community. Or being able to fund the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center. I was on that committee for 5 years, and being able to see now that this art center will be able to get the funding that it needs to continue to push in and create that or foster the arts ecosystem the way that the community has been wanting. These are things that will keep us together and keep us, you know, visioning together, especially in a time like right now when our arts are being attacked and the arts are carrying so much of our stories and our resistance and all of that. So ultimately, you know, these things are interlocked, and it's important that we do look to the past to kind of inform what we're doing for our futures. Yeah.
So just to go back there for a second, I already said Rukaya Adams, she should be the mayor. She's probably one of the very smartest people in our entire city. But Mac Smith, though, right? If you're listening to me right now, you've maybe never heard his name, but he's the publisher of a magazine in Portland, and it is a heritage magazine. He's been doing it for years, years and years and years. We Out Here magazine. If you've never heard of him before, Mac Smith should be a professor at Portland State University. But the other thing about Mac Smith, though, is that he takes news sensibility and puts it with philosophical understanding. Like he's a unique person. I'm just going to say Mac Smith, unique in the city of Portland historically and in the past 5 years or more, he's been doing a lot more to organize in mainstream arts organizations to get them to move forward more effectively. He, with you, curated this also historic art show, but it was more than that. Like you don't take one lane or one tool and stick with it. Mac Smith, his essay about police abolition is stand. It's unique. It stands. That should be in the Smithsonian somewhere because nobody knows more about that than he does, and he can bring the philosophical underpinning plus the factual underpinning. And just to build on that, right in Los Angeles right now, Donald Trump, the president, he sent the National Guard down there. He sent hundreds of Marines down there. They've mobilized the LA Police Department, one of the most brutal in the world, in case you were unaware. And they're trying to shut down all these protests against ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which at this time, just like in Portland in 2020, is grabbing people off the street. And in terms of the 2020 civil unrest, there was a man named Sergio Olmos. I think he's one of the greatest multimedia reporters in America today. He just happened to be working here in Portland at that time. He was stringing for the New York Times and all these people. Well, now he is based in California. He's been covering these ICE protests. And you guys, he was shot in the chest a couple of weeks ago with one of these, they're called sponge grenades. And they're launched out of grenade launchers. And he was interviewed in this big package by the Washington Post about violence against journalists. Look that up. I mean, what happened in Portland, it's almost in a way, it's like a traveling show that the Trump administration is going to bring to other cities, the ones that he calls the sanctuary cities. It's another reason to understand what's happening right now. I mean, could you just for a minute talk about like what does this Portland experience mean for the rest of the country now when we have a hostile government takeover?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Just the other day, my partner and I, we were just sitting in bed looking for stuff to watch, and that's really hard for us to find anything. But we were just talking, and I was like, "Do you know how Hawaii became part of the country?" Because we were like, "This is so strange that Hawaii is a part of this country." And we just clicked on some video about the history of it, and it says violent, as you would think, in terms of how that island was forcibly brought into the United States, like literally by bayonets being put at heads of the native Hawaiians. And it is so similar to what has happened with why Los Angeles is not part of Mexico to today. And Black people being forcibly brought over to this country to this day. And then this is one piece that I had to cut from my intro essay in Blackout, but I did post it on Instagram that Harriet Tubman was alive at the same time that Thomas Jefferson was alive. Harriet Tubman was also alive when Ronald Reagan was alive. Ronald Reagan ran on a platform of let's make America great again, and he won every state in America except for one. And so that may all seem convoluted, but ultimately what I'm saying is like these things are very interconnected, and the histories are so interconnected, and the time is actually not as far away as we like to believe. And so when we get into a present day and look at Donald Trump, one, Donald Trump is the fruit of a history of violence in this country, like state-sanctioned violence that has been happening pretty consistently. And when the basis of the country is wiping out people who are native to their own lands and then setting up governances or that also enforce that people couldn't live in places, couldn't eat in places, couldn't set up businesses in places, couldn't have vitality in their own places that they were forced to live anyways. And then we come to a time like now, and then the fruits of those governances are right in front of us, and we elect somebody that is who he is and told us along the way that he is who he is. Then it is not surprising. There's rarely anything in terms of what he's doing now that feels surprising, just in terms of his personality type, but he becomes even less like shocking when you just think about him in the context of history. Like, for real, this is definitely an American president. And now I think the challenge with all of it is like he is putting his thumb on the scale to see how far can I take this all? Who's really gonna stop me? What is really gonna stop me? And he's testing all of those things out in real time. And so, yeah, it can be in LA, it can be in a Portland, it can be in Chicago. I think he's toying with Chicago now as the next place to do these things, but he's been talking about Chicago for years. And I think that is something to continue to watch. And so, I'm not by any means, I don't have a crystal ball to be able to know exactly what his next moves will be, but I can say I won't be surprised by whatever the next things will be from him.
For the past 6 months, I've been wondering what role the uprisings in 2020 had with the current political moment, where people talk about the backlash, the political backlash. But Bruce Poinsett, in his essay in Blackout, talks about how the uprisings of 2020 weren't so much of an opportunity to set things right in the United States as much as they were just a stepping stone on the path to the Confederacy, which is it's harsh, but I've been thinking the same thing. Like, what's happening now is it's the logical conclusion to everything else that's happened before. And even the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court has never been an instrument of democracy in the United States. There have been times when they've, Roe versus Wade, even a broken clock is right twice a day. But now we're just seeing, and I do have a crystal ball. I actually collect crystal balls. And in the future, Donald Trump is going to maximize his profit from the office of president. I'm just putting that out. It's weird to listen to him this week talk about how, no, we really did destroy, we obliterated the Iranian nukes. No matter, don't listen to what those other people are saying. Don't listen to the guy, behind the curtain. Whatever, man. It's hard. It's hard to look at it, and yet I still keep thinking about how important Portland is. Portland is almost like the conscience of the United States. I mean, I don't know. That's just how it looks to me. And my mom's Donald Trump's mega fan. A friend who lives across the street insists that Portland was burned to the ground, insists on it. He won't listen to a word I say, and that blows my mind too. I'm not sure if I really asked you what your goal was with this project. What did you want to see happen?
I wanted to make sure that the anniversary of George Floyd's death in particular was not treated like a flashpoint and just kind of what I anticipated was, I don't think one is something, it's not like a holiday or anything. So I don't think a lot of people were tracking and like planning towards it, but I think it would have hit people's feeds and shared the post. And like, I remember I was out there or never forget, and then we go back to our lives. And that just didn't feel, it's not fair to what that actually was for us. And furthermore, like just coming out of COVID, I don't feel like the world has had any collective moment to step out of that and deal with what that was and what that disruption was to our lives. It was the first time, probably in any of our lifetimes, that we just saw not just the country, but the world stop for, stop most of its major functions. And like it was also dangerous outside. So it's like it felt very eerie to be in your life. And then we lost people too. Like we literally lost people to COVID during that time. Like I know some people who passed away from COVID. And so the what and then even funerals looked different in that time. Like grief, everything looked completely different. And during that time, people were talking about we're never going to forget. We're never gonna go back to the way things are. And yet and still like on the other side of COVID, it feels like the grind of like making money, hitting your rent, your mortgage, paying the bills. It feels like things are more expensive than ever. It feels like the memory is really short in terms of the things. We did reelect Donald Trump. We also had a president in front of us that was actively like losing his faculties, and it was just so many things that were happening in front of us. In more recent time, and definitely in regards to the movement around Black folks, we went from having abolition on the table to having it be respun to us that we actually what we need is hundreds more police for the Black community. That is what safety is for the Black community locally. That was like the narrative being spun. And so that was less than a year out. And so what I wanted was for us to like come back to root around what that actually was. If we're actually standing in the traditions of history and resistors and people who have put their foot on the line and their lives on the line and tried to make a different reality for us, then I think it's important to reach back in that time and kind of drag it along with us and remember, because it can be really easy to forget in some ways that that was only 5 years ago. That was only 5 years ago. And I also wanted for my own self, like some level of being able to be in conversation with people around these things, because I've had different conversations with people like off record, just about like, I don't really feel like that happened, or they don't care, and things like that. Even with like a Devin, Devin Boss, his essay is in the front of this for a reason. He's the first piece after my intro, talking about fronting the revolution and going from literally just playing basketball in his backyard, hearing about George Floyd, hearing about the protests, and going out there and being made to be out in front was not something that he was even going to do. He's just like, he was inspired by that time and then also felt ate up by that time, like in a way that was his mental, his physical, everything about him. And, I know it's been a hard thing for him to wrestle with, coming out of 2020, just what that all was. And so even with his essay, I wanted people, that may have been in, not just in the protest, just like not seeing that we all are people who are just actively fighting for our lives outside of whatever title that you may have tied to you, because he wasn't looking for any title and assumed one. And inside of that, just seeing like there is a real human impact for a person here, and that was genuinely just out there for community and for self, And so I think in it all, I just wanted to mark all of those things and ultimately just know that this was the largest global protest for Black lives in history. And it was every part of the globe had some level of protest, from cities to suburbs to Australia to France, Italy. The world was paying attention, and it took COVID. It took COVID. It took capitalism not moving in its typical functions. And it took that 17-year-old girl pulling out her camera and having a document of what actually was happening so that people could see it and couldn't really escape it, to produce that kind of emotion from people. And so, it, for me in it all too, there has been a little bit of fear, that is such a unique set of circumstances to have happen, to produce that outcome. And it is scary to know that it took less than a year for people to get away from the heat of some of those conversations. I will say, being able to have this magazine and think through some of the pieces, and even some of the kind of activations that I've made around it, I have been able to walk away with different points of being like, okay, we there were things that are worth grabbing onto, in terms of 2020, that were fruitful. Like it is, like I hosted an event at City Club last
I wanted to
week.
ask you about that. I wanted to ask you about that. What happened? What happened? I mean, the City Club is a super specific audience. It's that organization's more than 100 years old, and they've been convening people. Actually, it's a national thing. They've been convening people for years about research they do. They have research committees that go into the city and find things out. And like in the 1930s, they did a report about racial discrimination in Portland, so far ahead of their time. So let's just go there right now. So how did you get involved in the City Club? What did they invite you, or did you ask them? And how did that go?
Yeah, it was similar to the Portland Mercury, where I approached the Mercury and told them my vision for the magazine, and they hopped on board. And at that same time, I had approached City Club, unrelated to the Mercury, just related to like, hey, this anniversary is coming up. I would like to put something on to mark it. And then when the Portland Mercury was like, let's do Blackout together, then I was like, well, let's just merge these things because it makes sense for them to kind of be in conversation with each other. And so in that, I put together a panel of some of the authors that are in Blackout Soul. I was moderating a conversation with Sharon Gary Smith, Mack Smith, and Justice Raji about their essays, but beyond their essays, just kind of 2020 more broadly and where we're at. And even being on that stage where I was asking people about like what did come out of that, because on the pessimistic side of me is trying to find the pieces that like what was it? And Mac said, I went from being arrested by federal officers in front of City Hall in 2020 to now working for a city councilor inside of City Hall. Now 5 years later, that is a big deal. That was like an aha for me too. Like, yeah, that is a gain inside of this new form of government that we have that has already, I knew the new government that we have, it looks much different than what it's looked like before in terms of the diversity of people and thought that's there. But yeah, now the people that are advisors are a Mack Smith, and that is a big deal. And so in terms of that entire conversation at City Club, it was cool to see because they do have such a deep history here as a civic organization. They do their State of the City thing each year with the mayor, and they do the State of the State with the governor, and all these kind of marquee events that people really pay attention to. What are people saying? And so, because of Blackout, and what conversations I was having with them leading into this, they started a new series called State of Racial Justice. And so, this was the kickoff of the State of Racial Justice series. And so, it allowed us to go deeper with these conversations and not be filtered in what we had to say. And it felt good that we were able to do that in a way that didn't, it didn't have to feel buttoned up. I felt like I was just talking with the three of them. And it was received well, even for the start of it. I gave my kind of intro of like what brought me here, because inside of all these conversations about like systems and everything, it was nice to be able to share ultimately what brings me to these conversations, because I shared it in that space. I'm a fourth generation Portlander, and beyond that, like we just lost our family home like a month and some change ago. It was just sold to a developer off of Mississippi, and so like that was like our family home. That was like where we all, like every generation of my family has passed through that space. And we've held so many different, like our New Year's breakfast, it was like every extended branch of our tree, we'd be there, and my grandmother would make us be there. And block parties that we would have right there, it was on Missouri Street, so like two down from Mississippi. And just even beyond that, like going to a private school, like my mom made me go to this school in the West Hills for middle and high school. And so like the school I was at was built, it literally it the school is on acres now, but it is actually their first campus was where City Hall is today. And so it's just a school where people have these deep roots to the Ivy Leagues of the worlds, and they come from a lot of them come from multi-generations of money. They may not be the richest people in the world, but they come from money. And Meanwhile, my mom was, working overtime at TriMet, beating down her body just to have me at this school. And these type of things are the tensions that I'm kind of always thinking about, of like seeing where class and race and power and legacy, all those things kind of intertwine with each other. So I was able to kind of share those things in that space. I did a program that's a little different for City Club, even in the presentation of it, because we screened my film, Dear Young Black Portland, which when I was on your show last time, we talked a little bit about with Miss Sharon again. It was a visual letter filmed by Devin Boss, produced by my partner Zoe Piliafis, and written by me through the perspective of Miss Sharon. And it encapsulates so many of those things that I was just naming, like legacy and loss of her family home. And it was so surprising. That 7-minute film, when we got done with it, it was like met immediately by a standing ovation. And so even that shaping of that conversation, shaping of what brings us into that space and what gains and what losses, we're able to even talk about the people for Portland's of the world and how they were able to disrupt so many of the gains. But to be able to say those things frankly in a space like that doesn't allow us to have any of those losses chipped away without somebody saying something about it.
Right, right. We're starting to run out of show, and there's so much I still want to ask you about. I want to get into some of your other work, but I have to start by saying Zoe Piliafis, your partner, she's more than a partner, and she's another one of those people. She's not African American, but she's another one of the people who's one of the best and brightest people in Portland. And she has put together so many of the incredible connections that this city sees, multiracial across generations. She's put some of those together in different projects, events, art. Talk about her. What does she bring to your mix?
Yeah, I mean, even just leading into Blackout, she was able to support so many of the logistical pieces to bring this thing together. Like Blackout being a physical document versus like just an online thing, that was really important to me, like that it could be in people's hands. Coming to the Portland Mercury in December to get there meant we were kind of in a sprint to make it all happen and get these 40,000 copies to be real. And so having like amongst the different skill sets that Zoe has is like fundraising, and she was able to support with getting the word out, getting people to actually see the vision behind this thing, to say this is worth investing in, tapping on her networks while I'm tapping into my network to make this thing get to the number we need to actually get this thing in print. That was such a major piece, and just kind of sitting down with me. And even when I was reading all of each essay, she would be by my side, kind of as excited as I am to read each essay and kind of think about what it all meant in the context of things. So yeah, she's like partner and thought partner.
So again, I want to get into your films because you just made a film that I think was accepted into a film festival. But first, like we haven't even mentioned the 10-part podcast that you did about the uprising. So we need to touch, we need to ring that bell right now because I know a lot of listeners are going to want to go to iHeartRadio to pick up that podcast. So what's it called? What's it about? Tell us about it.
Yes, so Uprising, a Guide from Portland. It was made in 2021 and was part of the National iHeartRadio conglomerate. And it was me and a few other writers and journalists diving into what was happening still at that time with the protests, like, and kind of the history that informed the protests here in Portland, like the Black history. And it's not like a live talk. It was, we were hosting this, writing whole scripts, breaking down everything
I
from,
mean, it's an historic broadcast. It's a history. It's a history.
Yeah, everything from the Red House on Mississippi to when Joanne Hardisty took over as council president when Ted Wheeler was out during 2020, and kind of what that all meant for the protests during that time. It really was a cool thing to work on, and it was a different way of framing the protests, because there were a lot of every news outlet in the world was coming into Portland during that time. I was interviewed by the China Morning Sun and USA Today and, Wall Street Journal and LA Times, like Washington Post, like all these places are coming into town to talk to us about the protests. But even the best journalists, if you're dropping in, you can't get all of the meat of what makes the thing a thing. And so with Uprising, that was what was cool, was like we were, how can we tell this story now, and also give the history behind it? And there were hour-long episodes that we all kind of collaborated and said, how does this story have the most juice in it to give the world a real lens into Portland right now, because we knew the world was watching, and that it was kind of proven by the fact that it ended up in the iTunes top 100. We were sitting there looking at the numbers, during it. We're like, whoa, we're over Bill O'Reilly's podcast right now. We're over Joel Osteen's podcast and all of those kind of people. But it was a great thing to work on.
Okay, now in a few minutes left, I want to go into, like I said at the beginning, you're a griot, right? And one of the things that griots do is praise singing. Like, it's news, it's analysis, it's praise singing, it's holding up who's important and why they're important so that we all realize that we're all connected. So can you talk about your film career now and the film that's at the film festival and what you're doing next?
Yeah, so where are we going? We screened it at our event Black Friday at the Hollywood Theater, sold it out last year, and we were like, okay, we're not gonna do another Black Friday. We are gonna take this film and shop it around, because it needs to be seen, and it follow Intisar Abiotto and her mega curation at the Portland Art Museum, with Black artists dead and alive throughout the Northwest. And it dovetails with the story of Albina Vision Trust as the largest restorative redevelopment in the country. And it really just is a beautiful episode that Devin Boss filmed, and myself and Zoe Pilioffis executive produced alongside him with our producer, Elizabeth Stock. And so we are just in this place now where we are shopping it around, and we just won a silver award in Houston at the Houston International Film Fest. We won award just this past weekend for Best Featurette and the Los Angeles Film Invasion Film Festival. And we are screening in San Francisco. We're screening. We've got screenings lined up in Las Vegas and other places, because it is a story ultimately about home and how you make home. And it is a spotlight on Black Portland in a way that does deal with the hard parts, but also deals with like our creativity, our ingenuity, and how that resistance kind of shows up here. And I think a lot of people are finding reflection in that. And so that's what's cool, is as we're shopping this particular episode around, is that other people are getting to have conversations about what's happening in their own cities and states. And we're looking for this film to turn into a series where Devin, as the host, goes into the blackest zip codes across America and looks at how people are building home in their cities. And so that's the future of where we're going now.
Donovan Scribes, full disclosure, I have worked with Donovan in the past. I've known him for years. And Donovan, I don't think there's anyone else in this town who could tell the story of Portland that you can tell. I think you are the storyteller of our town, of our city. And I just want to take a moment and thank you for doing that because nobody else did it. And you hella did it. You hella did it. Any last message for our listeners? How can we support your work?
Right now I would say, where are we going? If you go to northeastprod.com/POP, you can bring a screening of the film to your city or to your organization, your school, whatever the case may be. We'd love to screen it in as many places as possible. And be on the lookout for my book. Because I'm going to be writing a book soon, and it will be diving into so much more of what you saw with Blackout, but this time it's going to be through me exclusively. And so that is something that we'll be sharing more about soon. So if you want to know more, you can tap in and you can email me at donovanscribes@gmail.com. And if you want to stay tuned with what I got going on, you can follow me on Instagram at Describes LLC.
All right, Donovan, thanks again for being with us on the show.
Yeah, thank you.
That's it for the show. Thanks again to Donovan. Read Blackout online at the Portland Mercury. That's portlandmercury.com/blackout. His website, donovanscribes.com. Hey, one last time, I'm going to tell you this right now. I mean, literally, like one last time. It's KBOO's summer membership drive. We're trying to raise $50,000. I'm suggesting someone listening right now could consider donating a little money every month. I recommend giving 1 hour's wage per month to KBOO. If you make $15 an hour, then give $15 a month. If you make $50 an hour, then give $50 a month. Your donation is tax deductible and life-changing. Give online at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number, 44321. Or on the app, you can tap the red button at the top that says donate, or you can send us a contribution in a physical envelope to KBOO Radio 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Special thanks to the entire KBOO Community Radio staff for making this all possible. KBOO Community Radio needs more volunteers, including on-air and broadcast board operators. Get involved by emailing volunteer@kboo.org. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.